Let's begin with the Serenity Prayer. My name is Karen, and I'm a compulsive overeater, so just join me in the Serenity Prayer, please. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. I've asked someone to do a little reading. She's going to come up and read to us from the little for today book. As I was looking over, if you take time, take the 29th, the 30th, and the 31st, and they're so timely to what we've talked about. So I've asked Constance to read for January 29. So, and she's going to hook you up.
Halfway down. There you go. Okay. To be nobody but myself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make me everybody else means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight and never stop fighting. E.E. Cummings. In OA, I'm getting to know myself. I no longer have to borrow from other people a way of thinking, looking, or being. I'm accepted for what I am, and in turn, I can accept myself. I can be spontaneous. I can reach out and be close to others. Even when I'm alone, if I'm in touch with myself, I am not lonely. To have the courage to be me, to accept myself without glossing over the truth. These are the goals toward which this program is directing me. For today, in accepting myself as I am, I accept God's will for me today. Only through self-acceptance am I able to change.
Thank you.
You're doing a great job.
Isn't she wonderful?
Yes.
I just telling her how lovely she is. And it's helped me so much. Okay, then we're going to be talking steps 3 and step 11, step 3 and 11 today, because they're kind of the spiritual types of because we talked about step 1 and 2, and it came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then step 3 becomes the way that we connect to the spiritual part of the program. And I think that we make that decision, but then on a daily basis, we need to connect with our higher power, and that's why I like putting those two together, step 3 and step 11. And I've asked Laurie to read from the big book, it's in the appendix, The Spiritual Experience.
Hi, I'm Lori. I'm a compulsive overeater. The spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from compulsive overeating has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that the personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden, spectacular unheavals. Happily, for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described, though it is not our intention to create such an impression. Many compulsive overeaters have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware that the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any compulsive overeater capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. The principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
That's really a really powerful reading, isn't it? And I want to talk about that very last thing that he quotes from Herbert Spencer that says, we can only be defeated by, what does it say? An attitude of contempt prior to investigation. And that's where I want to start this morning. When I talk about my spiritual journey, there's only one of me. I was sharing that with somebody this morning. There's only me. It's just me. I'm not divided by my spiritual part, my emotional part, my physical part. But I don't think I really knew that when I came here. And there is a difference between my spiritual part and my body, but we're all one. You know, we're really one, and so everything affects the other. But when I came into the program, I was aware that I had a problem with my body. I was aware that I had a problem with eating and body weight. I knew that, and that's why I really came here. And I was a little bit aware that I had some emotional things going on, because I just felt crappy inside. Sorry about that. I just felt awful so much of the time, and I didn't know what to do about it any more than I knew what to do about my food. And so that's why I had to use food to stuff down that uncomfortable feeling of not being okay to be in my body. And we talked about that this being a process. And in the very beginning, one of the reasons I liked the 12 steps is they were spiritual, and I already knew about spiritual. So when we'd read about step 3 and turning your life will over, I would think, well, I already know that. Well, I already do that. And that was the whole part that OA would do in the spiritual realm. I would think, well, I don't really need to work on that because I already have that down. I just want to work on the food and the emotional stuff because that's what I really need. And so I knew that I still, when I started slipping and sliding with abstinence, then I wanted to know why. And I was scared to know why. I was really afraid to know why. And I think, now that I look back, I don't know about you, but my learning, as I go through things, I don't really realize what's coming out of it till I get past it and then look back. That's how my spiritual awakening has been. But all of a sudden, I began to realize part of it was my fear, and I mean fear to the deepest core of me, was that you were going to tell me that I was wrong. Because I had found the way spiritually. And I found the way. And remember I told you felt like I needed to convert people to my church at the beginning because I knew the right way. And that was because that little girl decided a long time ago that she wasn't good enough. So you had to find the right person, the right way to think. You had to scope out the rules. And then once you got them, then you worked really hard at living up to that so you could be acceptable to other people and to God. And even though I had heard that my God loved me no matter what, there was still this black and white thinking for me that it's, if I'm right, then you have to be wrong. And I think that's one thing OA gave me, was the ability to quit judging other people and quit thinking that I had to find all the answers or that somebody had to be all the answers for me. That I think that's one of the most profound changes that happened to me, because I was always looking for the right minister or the right teacher or the right professor in college or the right find out the right theology, or not just theology but philosophy of teaching. I mean, all those things I had to do, the right one. And then I would get to know these people and they were human and they made mistakes. And then I'd have to fire them because they weren't that guru that I needed, that had all the answers, because I knew, even though I found the right way, I knew I didn't have all the answers. And so there was this terrible fear in me that you were going to say that I was wrong. Not you, but the program. But what happened was, when I started slipping and sliding with abstinence, and even before I came into the program, no matter how I was doing my life, it wasn't working well. And when that one young woman said, well, Karen, if your faith is the answer to all your problems like you say it is, why are you still fat? That touched that button that says, why am I still fat? Why can't I stop that? And so that was like that little crack in my armor that says, maybe you could open up your mind. Just maybe you could just be open and not know all the answers. And see, you remember me talking about Mrs. God? It's crazy to think that I had to, I had this God that I loved so much, but I had to defend him because people might not believe him and then they would go to hell, and so I had to protect him. Isn't that crazy? That's when I say Mrs. God is just ludicrous. It's just ludicrous, but my crazy thinking was that way. I couldn't just let go. So when something isn't working, then I had to, especially my food. And I hated it when people said in meetings, I'm so grateful that I'm a compulsive overeater because I would never be able to find this program. And I'd think, no way. I hate being a compulsive overeater. It's not fair. I hate it, and I'll never be grateful for it. And now I don't know that I'm grateful that I've had to be, that I have this illness. I'm really not grateful because it's a terrible illness. And it would have been nice if I didn't have it. That part I still think I believe. But now I've come to the place of acceptance, but it's okay. It's just okay. And I think that all my process in recovery has been, that's why I like talking about food and that writing helps me to see that that food was the love of my life. And when I realized it turned on me, the idea that I had to let go of it was like a death experience. It was like my dearest friend died. And I had to adjust to that. And I think the 12-step program helps you go through the stages of grief. I really do. And in the first place, you're in denial. And then you get into that place where you're bargaining. If I just do this, I'll stay on this diet, you help, that kind of thing. And then there comes that period of anger. And I remember in the early days of OA when I was abstaining and I couldn't have things that other people had, it just made me really, really angry. It wasn't fair. That was my mantra. It just isn't fair. I know I'm a compulsive eater, but why can't other people eat what they want to? Later on, and still be thin. Later on, I realized that they really didn't want to eat like I do. When they got full, they were full. I wanted to eat with the way I wanted to eat and get thin. you know, I wanted to eat everything I wanted and get thin. And that's not the real life, you know. So when things weren't working for me, then I really did have to open my mind. And I really think that's why when Will and Jane says that, it's contempt prior to investigation. My husband was saying the other day that he didn't like, he never watched the Waltons on TV. Before he knew me, he thought he knew all the answers back then. And his way of looking at life was opposite my way of looking at life. And he thought they were just too soupy. I said, did you watch it? Because they have that advertisement where they say goodbye. Now they're, yeah, that one. And I said, do you remember that? No. And I said, well, how did you know you didn't like it? And he said, I just knew I wouldn't like it. And then, because he worked the program, I could just smile and say, oh, contempt prior to investigation. Okay, so when I started breaking through the denial and I was breaking through and working on the anger, I think that was a good stage. I think that was part. I had to just get really, really angry and feel the anger until I could let it go. And I think that's true with my food, too. When I finally, there's a person that used to hear in OA that he was a speaker. He's not with us anymore. He's passed away. But he says that recovery to him is like being given back his own choice. When I'm eating the food, when I'm overeating, when I'm into my compulsion, I don't have a choice. And he says that someday there comes that time when it's just going to be you and God. It's going to be me and God and the refrigerator. And I have to get to that place where I can make the choice I really want to make instead of obsession taking over. So when things weren't working, I had to say I wanted my faith in a box. I needed it to be exactly what to do, and because God was my only hope. And I remember when I first started saying that I could see things differently, and you could have ideas, and I could have ideas, and we could both be right. Ooh, that just gritted against me, you know. And it was scary. But I was in that life raft we talked about. And I could get out or I could stay in. But I didn't want to go back to my compulsive eating, so I stayed in. And then, you know, living behind that facade I had with all these cycles going on was really uncomfortable. And I came to believe that part of my that wasn't true. I mean, I was lying to people because I wasn't able to be honest with who I was. I didn't intend to lie, but that's what was going on. And what I knew was there was part of me that could fool God. I mean, fool you, but I knew the jig was up with God. That God really knew me and really. And so I had to come to a place where I really could believe that my higher power loved me no matter what. We talked about Sister B. I was sharing with somebody else that had heard her, and my favorite part in her story is when she'd been a nun for years and years before she became an alcoholic, and then after she became an alcoholic, she came into AA, and she said when she came to the seventh step, in that seventh step prayer, it asks, that we give all of ourselves over to God, the good and the bad. And she said she was kneeling down and saying this prayer, and she said when it said, you know, I give my all of me to you, and then the good and the bad, she said it was like this voice came and said, B, do you really mean it? Do you really mean it, B? And she said, I just started crying, and that broke through. That was a big crack for her spiritual awakening, because for years she had told other people that God loves you more than anything. He holds you in the palm of his hand. I told people that over and over, but I couldn't believe it for me. And that's why I loved her so much, because she still had her faith. She still was vital. And in fact, her church finally gave her the mission of, she had a place and she was able, they paid her to go out when she would go out and speak at retreats and stuff for the 12-step program. And I think what a gift she was to the program and what a gift she was to the church to make that connection. But I love that, because that's the thing. That's breaking down that who I am, all of me, is lovable to God. One time, I talk about getting up in the night and writing, and I remember one night I woke up and I was coming through the worst part of my valley, and but I woke up and I'd been listening to the tapes of a speaker from a retreat who lived in Canada, and she'd been talking about that voice in her head. She gave it a name, that critical voice that was always telling her that she was wrong. She gave it a name, and that way she could talk to it. And she had some, I think, a picture of a priest or somebody that she'd known before that was just, you know, that kind. And so this, I just heard that. And this one night I woke up, and I was just going on all the things I hadn't done, and you should have done that, and how come you didn't do that? That critical voice was so strong. And so I got up in the night, and I started to write, and then I thought, and I think this is higher power, then I thought, that's not higher power waking me up in the night, because I always wrote to God. I know my sons. I could have been really upset with them about things and need to talk to them about things, but I would never have woken them up in the middle of the night and started this litany, because I love them. So God wouldn't do that to me. There's another voice in my head. And I pictured this steely gray-haired lady that pulled it straight back so far that her, you know, her eyes were going. And I named her Abigail. And I just said, Abigail, you know what? I know you're concerned about me, but I'm going back to bed and I'm going to sleep. We're not talking about this tonight. And I went back to bed and I went to sleep. And I'm glad that I had that experience and heard that tape. If I hadn't heard that tape, that wouldn't have come to me. See, you go to these places, you listen to tapes, and you don't even know what they're going to do for you. And then when you need it, it's there. And so I used Abigail for the longest time, and I used that, and it really helped me. And then God has a good sense of humor. I have three granddaughters. And when the third one was about to be born, my son said, we've got a name for the baby. And I said, oh, really? And she said, it's going to be Abigail Jane. And I thought, okay. So that was kind of nice, because I didn't need that name anymore. You know, I had gotten to the place where I had worked through a lot of that stuff. And I'll tell you, my Abigail is a delight. She's like my little butterfly, and she just flits from thing to thing, except when she got into junior high. She came to me one day and when she was visiting, and she said, Grandma, I'm a woman now. Now here was this little, just effervescent, just a delight. And I said, oh, she said, and when I told my mom, she said, she cried. I said, oh, but you know, you're going to be a wonderful woman. And the next time she came, she was dressed all in black. She was humped over. She had a hat that came down over her eyes. And I thought, where did my Abby go? And now she's turning 16 in March, and she's a delight again. But you know, that's how God does things for me. I have a stage, and that stage teaches me something, and then I move on to another stage. But it was so important for me to know that other Abigail. And I just think it's great that I was able to change that around later on. Okay, so the program, by going to the meetings and reading things over and over and over, the program just gradually changed me, gradually, gradually, gradually. My thoughts and my belief systems started changing. And I say that to you that are younger, because I wanted to work it fast. But I want you to know that even though I look back and say how much those things have helped me, I had help all the way along. Otherwise, I wouldn't have stayed. Every stage, when I was first there, I had friends, I heard wonderful things, and they helped me, because that was what I was ready to hear at that point. But I really encourage you, even if you go through struggles, to keep coming back, because if you keep coming to these meetings, you're affirmed over and over by the words we say and the life people, you can see the way they're living. This program works. And if you truly believe this program works, then you can keep coming. Why else would we want to do the inventory steps? Why would we ever go and make amends if we didn't think this was going to free us from our compulsion? And it's worked for thousands of alcoholics, and it's worked for thousands of compulsive eaters, and I believe, and lots of other addicts, and I believe this program works for me too. Okay, so when I got to that place where I was open-minded and I said, okay, maybe I don't have all the answers spiritually. I was really at step one in my spiritual life. I think my emotional and physical stuff had maybe advanced a little bit, but I was really at step one. And that's why I talk about going to the meetings, and that really helped me. I have to tell you, though, I didn't always like what it said in those stupid books. You know? And when it told me that if there's an axiom, what maybe somebody who's more in that big book, I can't remember quote it, but if there's a no, it's in the 12 by 12 of A. There's a spiritual axiom that
it's
the problem is me, right? And I didn't. That's stupid. I didn't believe that. And so I had to rail against that for a while. And there were a lot of things that it said. And there was a man that goes to meetings in our area, and he led a retreat with me down in Central Oregon one time. And he told the story about his sponsor told him early on. And he grew up in Brooklyn, and he just tells it as it is, I'll tell you. And he said he was struggling with something, and his sponsor was pretty hard-nosed, and she said, I want you to get into the big book, and I want you to read the chapter on the pages on acceptance every day for 30 days, and then we'll talk about it. So he read it for a couple days, and it just, you know, that's that doctor, it's that doctor alcoholic pig. And he said, it made me so mad, I finally just took that book, and I tore those pages out, and I threw them. And he said, then when he met his sponsor after that, she said, well, how's the reading going? And she said, let me see your book. Let's read it together. And she opened it up, and they were gone. And she said, go get you another big book and leave it alone, she said. And there was a woman that came to our meetings on Friday nights. For a while, we had a study. I think it was a big book study, and we were at a hospital in downtown Tacoma. This woman drove from Enumclaw. You know, that's quite a little ways. And Friday night in the traffic after you work full time. I'll just never forget, we did the reading, and it came her turn to share, and she just slammed the book on the table, and she said, I hate this stuff. I hate this stuff. She said, you know, I drove all the way here, and then I have to hear this stuff, and it just gives me a headache. And then she shared about how that impacted her and so forth. And I had to do that. I had to go to meetings, hear the stuff, you know, argue in my head, go out, try to live it, come back, go to the meetings. And, you know, sometimes people say, I haven't worked the steps. If you've been going to meetings and you're studying the steps, the steps are working on you. You know, maybe there's a way you need to walk through them specifically, but every time you read those steps and talk about it, the steps are working on you. I really believe that. So we had to go through our little fits, and then one of the things that helped me as long, you know, when I was going through that was to say, well, just set aside the idea if it's right or wrong or whatever. Just know that what you're doing is not working. I love that. I think it's a Dr. Phil thing that we hear now these days. It's a quote I love. How's that working for you? And I think you can say that really sarcastically, or you can say it really lovingly. And I do believe that I have to tell myself that. Well, Karen, you could say with it, but how's that working for you? Okay. So step three was really about then my coming to grips with these cycles. My perfectionism, I'm going to start with the last one, my overeating, my hating myself, dieting, gaining weight back again, and then hating myself, and you know, that whole cycle. And I'm sure all of us, anybody that's a compulsive overeater, whether it's losing weight or gain, you know, whatever that is with food, it's part of our life. And then that perfectionism and procrastination, because all this touches all aspects of my life. And so as I was working the steps through and through all the things that were going on in my life, I had to deal with that cycle again and try to make an intervention in that cycle. So I didn't have to keep going through it. Kind of an intervention. And that's how the program, I think, worked for me, was all of a sudden, you know, you can do it a different way. And all of a sudden, pretty soon, I realized, you don't have to be perfect, Karen. And if you really accept who you are and accept that God loves you just the way you are, then it isn't anybody else's business what you do. It really isn't. And isn't your business what other people think of you. And I heard those things at meetings, and gradually I was able to be who I was. And if I do that, I don't have to get into that perfect. And I wish I could tell you I never get into it. That's why I have my little ever-ready bunny, because, you know, I talk about my pacing when I'm feeling frustrated. It's my cycles going again, and I just pace and pace. Somebody told me last night that when they're on the phone, they find themselves walking. So she said, I figure that's exercise, so I just walk. If I know the pacing is not getting me anywhere, then I just sort of have to, you know, make that intervention. Also about the being too busy, that people-pleasing and overcommitment and then not knowing what to do. Somebody asked me about that, how do you get that stopped? Well, you have to sort of, I couldn't just get rid of every responsibility I had right at one time. But the process helped me to, whenever I get feeling that way and I had to complete a project that I didn't want to do, then I taught myself some things to do before I get the project. It's like when somebody asks me, for instance, when they asked me to do the retreat, they asked me you asked me at the convention, and I told her I need at least a day to pray about this before I make that commitment. And I really try to do that. I really try to go inside and turn it over and get that and look at my schedule too and see how my time is going to be committed. And then I really get a feeling of, yep, I think this is going to be okay. Instead of my ego saying, oh, they want me to lead a retreat, it'll be so cool. And then we're getting ready and think, oh my gosh, why did I say yes? I don't know about you guys. I do that sometimes in program as well as outside. So that too was the development of the program changing me so I could accept me inside. And then that magical thinking. And I talked about that yesterday. You know, part of that reason was I think that I went through my adolescence and didn't really go through that process. I think I didn't want to be an adolescent. I wanted to be an adult, so I just skipped it. I mean, I lived through it, but I just skipped it. So in my program, we talk about the stages of development. I had to be an adolescent for a while. And after I left my marriage, I was crazy as a hoot owl in lots of ways. I just felt like this young girl. And I just felt so cool. And I was, you know, I was free. And it was crazy. And it felt crazy. But it felt good, too. And I was rebelling. I mean, I had, my family didn't understand me, the people at my job didn't understand me, and my friends didn't understand me, and it was kind of fun. I mean, I remember going getting some clothes that looked like, I mean, really wild things that I never, and I had friends who, I fell in love with some artistic people that were in the program, and this one lady, I just loved her, and she never wore earrings that matched. She always wore one of this kind and one of that kind. And I thought, if I can get to the place where earrings that don't match, that'll be cool. And the best I could get was a friend gave me earrings that one was white and one was black. It was the masks of drama, you know. And I wore those proudly. So there was this part of me, and I know that probably my kids and the people that love me thought, oh, Karen, because I was going through adolescence and menopause at the same time. And it doesn't look so cute, you know, to everybody else. But like everybody else, I did. But if I don't go through those stages, then they back up on me. They back up on me. And so when I don't need to have that. And I remember when I started teaching career guidance classes, when I was in grad school, I took this one test, and it was right in the middle of my adolescent stage, and one area of my life, it was artistic, creative person, and I have that part of me, but it went clear out to the peg. I mean, it was like I was in the 99th percentile. Well, I'm not really in the 99th percentile, but, and then a year or so later when I was teaching the class, I used this and I took it again, and it was back down where it belonged, and some of the others were my conventional part. See, there's this artist in me, and there's that conventional part in me that needs to have order, and the artist that says, "Pooey, we got to do something fun, creative and stuff." And so they both kind of balanced out, and I realized I'm not crazy. I just have those two personalities, and that's helping me balance. So I'm not too anal retentive, and I'm not too loose over here. You know what I'm saying? So I had to tell you about my menopause and my adolescence. Then, as I walked through this process, I got more. I could feel that enduring strength coming into me, and that's what step one is all about. That we didn't have any enduring strength, and as I got stronger and stronger, then I was able to turn my life over. That's what I was doing on a regular basis. I was turning my life and my will over to the care of God.